This is Everything is Workable, a podcast that examines how every experience, every situation, every moment is an opportunity to work with our mind. I'm your host, Caitlin Hatch, creative polymath and dedicated consumer of wisdom. In this season, I've been talking with others about their approach to life and practice, but this week, I'm in solitary retreat. I didn't want any of my guests to miss out on my usual flurry of episode promotion, so I'm going old school and doing a reflective episode on my own practice, specifically around compassion and how we understand it as a society, how we can embody it, and the power it has to create change. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it. Spread it around on social media, email it to a friend, whatever works for you. I really appreciate all of the help with getting this to an ever wider audience. Also, I am looking for guests still for this season. You can visit CaitlinSCHatch.com and click on podcast to find the guest application form. If there's someone in your life who you really appreciate and think should be on the show, please suggest them. And now on with this week's episode. As a deep thinker, I've spent quite some time reflecting on how, as a society, we put so much value on aggression and violence. Despite teaching our children that it's wrong to use violence when they're upset or someone has hurt them, this isn't how we conduct ourselves as adults. Social influences of patriarchy and toxic masculinity reinforce the idea that aggression has merit. Truly, the message that we're sending children isn't violence is wrong and not a way we should solve our problems, so much as violence is unacceptable when you are a child, but not when you are an adult. The thing is, I have seen absolutely no example of a time when aggression led to resolution. Even in the face of people who claim their anger galvanized them to action, I don't see resolution. And this isn't naivety on my part. It's not as if I don't understand why people get angry. I am, after all, a human being, and have been pretty, what I felt, was justifiably angry many times. But when I reflect on a long history of violence, one which is easily studied, I see how acting from a place of fear and anger benefits no one. I appreciate that the Holocaust was not the pinnacle of human brutality and cruelty. Just looking at World War II alone, that was not the only atrocity being committed. From Japanese internment camps in Canada and the US, to the work camps run by the Japanese throughout occupied Asia, to the annihilation of two cities with atomic bombs, on top of what the Nazis were doing, which was appalling. It's hard to say that there were any winners in that war, that there are any winners in any war. And it's also not to say that atrocities should be ranked against one another. This was a slow lesson that I learned from contemplating a question given to me by my history teacher when I was 17. He asked our class why Hitler is considered worse than Stalin. There was much debate about this, but now, in my 30s, I realized that what he was really pointing at was our need to rank suffering at all. Our need to somehow classify and grade the evil of which anyone is capable detracts from the understanding that we should never cause harm. Ultimately, it's not a question of whether or not one violation or total disregard for human rights is any worse than another. Being on the side of good should not justify brutality. But where does compassion come in to all of this? When we're talking about extreme acts of violence and force, how else are we meant to combat them? If Allied forces hadn't dropped atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki and rallied against the rule of Nazi Germany, where would we be today? This is where unpacking compassion becomes really important. And understanding foresight, hindsight, and what it means to have skillful means. We understand the words that we use from what we are taught about them, or the associations we learn through media, or our places of worship, people in our social circle, families, whatever. A dictionary definition of compassion states that it is sympathetic pity and concern for the suffering and misfortune of others. I can see how this is problematic. A lot of dictionary definitions are. What woman would want to feel sympathy for the man who chose to rape her? What impoverished single mother could feel sympathy for a politician who voted on a bill that took away her child support? What trans individual's family would feel sympathy for a group of people who murdered their child? What Muslim would find sympathy for the person who burned the Quran and made their spiritual path synonymous with terror? What black family could feel sympathy for the police officer who killed their child simply because being black and wearing a hoodie automatically makes you suspicious? I get it. These are the examples that I hear all the time. The reasons people give as to why compassion just doesn't have a place in certain situations. But I get curious, and I want to know what it is that people are arguing against when they're arguing against compassion. How I understand a word isn't necessarily how you're going to understand a word. The definition of a word is not inherent within it. If it was, we'd have a universal human language. Language also evolves. Words like sympathetic and pity have changed from what they originally meant, which was more in line with what we now refer to as empathy. Where sympathy used to be commonly understood as understanding between people, it has come to be seen more as like feeling sorry for the suffering of another. Pity also used to encompass compassion. Compassion was actually in the definition of pity when I looked it up, although it was seen more as a sense of sorrowful compassion for another. Again, pity has been reduced to mean feeling sorry for, although also with a note of condescension that sympathy doesn't generally carry. For example, a wealthy individual who thinks that their wealth is entirely as a result of their hard work might look at someone who is homeless with pity. At the same time, someone who considers themselves to be incredibly compassionate could look at that wealthy person with pity because they feel like they are above the greed they presume this individual to have. Pity is not a relationship between equals. Empathy, however, is defined as the ability to understand and share the feelings of others. And for me, this is far more in line with my definition of compassion and the way that I've come to understand it. As a Buddhist practitioner, I've heard a multitude of definitions for compassion, as it's a word many teachers turn to when translating words like maitri or metta, which is the same thing, also means loving kindness, and compassion is an aspect of loving kindness, and bodhicitta, which is a huge word to get into, so I'll just drop it if you want to look it up. Research bodhicitta, I recommend it. These are words that have no singular English translation, basically. A combination of various words are used, including empathy, tender heart of sadness, forgiveness, kindness, love, and compassion. My favorite definition of compassion comes from Annie Pema Chodron, who describes it as our ability to relate with. This definition clarifies that compassion is a relationship between equals. It is our ability to see the humanity in another person. It does not rank their value or dismiss them as evil or less than human. It recognizes the capability we all have for great kindness as well as for great animosity, and is inclusive of the well-being of every individual involved. But this still doesn't address what compassion really is, or I guess to put it in a more clear way, what compassion looks like when we're talking about it as something that we should use as a valuable tool. Before I get into that though, I'm going to talk about what compassion isn't. The impression I often get is that compassion is seen as something that's weak or soft, that it's mutually exclusive from discernment, or about being nice to people that we don't like. But compassion is not about opening ourselves up to abuse or suffering. In fact, to do that wouldn't be very compassionate. It's important to note that compassion is inclusive of the entire situation and all parties involved. Opening ourselves to harm is most definitely not compassionate. Compassion is also not about condoning or dismissing harm. Compassion doesn't forget. Compassion also does not absolve anyone of their agency and personal responsibility. As an act of relating with, compassion is a way in which we can remain open to another person as a human being. Compassionate action acknowledges the suffering behind the actions of others. To illustrate this better, I'm going to get really personal. I'm a survivor of an emotionally and mentally abusive relationship. I recognize how isolated my abuser is as a result of holding impossible expectations of others. I can reflect on our relationship and see how much they suffered, and are probably still suffering, because of their inflexibility and the need to control those around them, myself included. I don't like them, and I've completely removed them from my life because that is safest for my mental well-being. But I harbor no anger or hatred towards them because that is also good for my mental well-being. In fact, they taught me how painful life is when we hold on to and justify anger because that's how they lived their life. I wish nothing but happiness for this person, because I recognize that when someone is happy, which is to say, content and at ease with the ambiguity of life, they don't cause harm. If they were to genuinely understand happiness, free of materialism, they would recognize the harm that they had caused and take responsibility for it. Getting to this place was not instantaneous for me. It took a lot of time and self-reflection. I have forgiven them multiple times for multiple transgressions, taking baby steps to open my heart, because ultimately, an open, compassionate heart feels better to me than a closed-down, fearful, or angry one. The time it takes is completely dependent on every individual, and I totally get that. We have our own capacities, and we need to work to those, and there's no point in pushing ourselves to feel more compassionate than we actually do. And the process is going to be different for different people. For me, the process involved asking a lot of questions, questions which continue to be valuable and will follow me for my entire life. Things like, does anger serve me? Does anger allow for possibility? Do I feel a sense of healing when I hold on to anger? Do I communicate well from a place of anger? Does it truly protect me while also easing mind and body? How do I react when I encounter anger in another? Am I more or less inclined to listen to them? Am I more or less inclined to feel angry myself? I've also come to understand that many actions which could be done out of anger could also be done out of compassion, and that intention matters a great deal when it comes to how effective and lasting any one action will be. Any act done out of anger begets more of the same. To go back to the example of World War II, the tension was never resolved. This is where foresight and hindsight come in. World War II led to the Cold War, which led to Russia-occupied Afghanistan, which led to the Taliban, which led to Daesh, which leads to what we see today with the Syrian refugee crisis and regular bombings and attacks throughout the world. The more fearful we are and the more we act out of anger and lash out to people that we don't understand without a willingness to get to know them and relate with them, the more animosity we breed and the more of this stuff we're gonna see. Of course, it's not all bleak. History also offers us examples of compassionate action. It's there. When I look at footage of the civil rights movement, for example, of black men and women being attacked, they're walking down the road and they're being sprayed with fire hoses, or they're kicked, or they're pushed, they're pulled away from counters and thrown into the street. I don't see pushovers or weaklings. I see dignified human beings who are not giving in to the abuse they are experiencing, but are also not lashing out from fear or anger. By conducting themselves the way they do, they're inviting everyone to bear witness. Bear witness to the brutality of racism. The non-violent aspect of that movement came from a recognition that retaliation from the same place of fear and anger would not lead to resolution or healing. In order for anyone to heal, everyone needed to heal. And it's not that fear and anger are not there. We should neither repress nor deny these emotions, or any emotion. Acknowledging emotions as destructive or non-beneficial is not the same as saying that they are wrong, or that we are bad for feeling them. The idea is to learn to abide with them, to listen to what they're communicating, and then respond appropriately, instead of simply reacting. In learning to abide with anger that I've felt, I've learned that anger is basically a mask for fear. Fear is the result of being unprepared or stepping into the unknown. It makes sense that anger follows on from fear, especially when we're taught that anger protects us. When we feel threatened, we want to do anything we can to get rid of that feeling. Like I said earlier, a patriarchal society steeped in toxic masculinity has taught us that the appropriate response to a threat is to become a bigger threat. And it doesn't matter what your gender identity is, we turn to anger easily because it's what we've been fooled into believing will alleviate our fear. But the fear doesn't go away when we turn to anger, just as anger does not go away when we act from it. The idea of catharsis for anger is absurd and has been proven not to be true. In fact, acting from anger just encourages us to act from anger more. It builds up those neural pathways. ignoring fear only makes our fears bigger too. But when we sit with our fear, instead of masking it with anger or retreating into it and collapsing, we'll begin to peel back another layer. Beneath this is what is called the tender heart of sadness in Buddhism. I'm not too familiar with other spiritual pathways, so I don't want to say what it might be akin to in, say, Christianity, but I'm going to guess that most religions have this. It can be described in many ways. It's the awareness of impermanence. It is the awareness of the suffering inherent in the human condition. It's our understanding that we and those we love will experience sickness, will get old, and will die. These things are unavoidable. And while this might seem bleak, this circles back to compassion and our ability to relate with others. The tender heart of sadness does not belong to us as individuals. It is a collective human experience. It is the raw truth of our humanity. We are fragile beings on a space rock that has sustained a multitude of different living organisms for longer than we can fathom. We are tiny blips on the history of the universe. But then we are intrinsically part of the same universe. We are a condition of innumerable causes that led to each of our unique human births. We are a single element of something much bigger than us, and yet we're all part of it. And so, when we embody compassion, when compassion is the intention behind everything we say and do and think, we generate more of the same. But don't take my word for it. This is work we must each embark upon for ourselves. In life, we will always be our own greatest teacher. It's up to us to ask the question, does this serve? Does my anger serve? Can we find examples when our anger or someone else's anger has not accelerated a situation towards further aggression or animosity? Can we find examples when our anger has transformed us or others in positive ways? Is our aversion to acting compassionately because we think it won't be effective, or because it's actually easier to respond from anger than it is to do this kind of work of relating with? And it is work. I get that it's work, trust me. I don't for one second think that this isn't difficult. But I also don't think that compassion is something that is inherent. Nothing is inherent. Which means that it's a skill we can all learn. Just like we can learn to get much better at being angry. And we can ask ourselves, in a year, do I want to be angrier? Do I want to feel more animosity? Do I want to move into realms of hatred? Do I want to emphasize my fear? Do I like how it feels in my gut, or in my heart, or in my mind? Or would I rather have a more open heart? I get that this might seem lofty or ethereal, but from my experience, this is an extremely practical approach. We can see it modeled everywhere, and the people who model it are greatly admired, like Nelson Mandela, for example, or Martin Luther King, the Dalai Lama, Gandhi. Those are big public figures, but I see it modeled by the teachers that I admire, the ones that I talk about on this show, Elizabeth Mattis Namgal, Anupama Chodron, Sharon Salzberg. These are people who understand that we cannot bring the world in which we live to a static, fixed place in which there will be no suffering. But they are also people who show me what embodied compassion looks like. They tell me about their experiences, about the anger that they felt towards an ex-husband or some friend of theirs who betrayed them, and how they worked through that, that they used that anger not as a catalyst to put up barriers, but as a catalyst towards compassion, to develop this kind of compassionate heart. Impermanence and interconnectedness means that the world will always be dynamic. There will always be suffering, and humanity will always be capable of incredible atrocities. With this in mind, I don't want to become smaller and more fearful, because this stuff is going to keep happening. But I also recognize that impermanence is what gives life richness and texture. It's what makes us capable of true greatness. Because of impermanence, we can grow. We can change. We can become kinder, more loving beings. we each get to make that choice. Not because we think that we're better than someone else or different than anyone else, but because we recognize our sameness. Because we see that we are humanity, each and every one of us. If each of us does our part, that is enough. And to me, that's what makes this worth it. If you enjoyed this episode, I recommend listening to a few others from past seasons of Everything is Workable, including one titled Compassion from season one. There's also one called Being Human. That one's really good too. And Basic Goodness. Also, please share this through social media since I'm in retreat and won't be going online. My life purpose is to help people engage with their own curiosity and to live happy, generous, compassionate lives. My gratitude to you for sharing this with even one other person is immense. Thank you as well to Dexter Britton for the fabulous music accompanying this and the last two seasons. The show will be back next week with an interview once again. I am still looking for people to interview, so if you have a suggestion, someone that you think would be awesome, or you yourself think you would be really awesome for the show, visit CaitlinSCHatch.com and click on the podcast link to fill in the guest application.